Hey, if you're interested in learning more about how cutting-edge technologies like natural language processing can help automate your security response, you might want to register for our November 14th webinar, sponsored by the firm Empow Cybersecurity. I'll be speaking with Empow founder and CEO Avi Chesla about how natural language processing can be used to break out of the SIEM big rules paradigm. To register for the webinar, just point your browser to securityledger.com/no rules. That's one word. securityledger.com/no rules. Hello, and welcome to the Security Ledger podcast. I'm Paul Roberts, editor-in-chief at the Security Ledger. In this episode of the podcast, number 119, Internet of Things device makers beware. AT&T is partnering with the networking equipment firm Ericsson to certify the security of IoT endpoints. And if you can log into yours with admin, you might be in trouble. In our second segment this week, we're going to speak with Senthil Ramakrishnan, a lead member of AT&T's Internet of Things security group, to learn about the certification program. But first, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, or EFF, earned its stripes in the 1990s at the vanguard of groups opposing the U.S. government's efforts to ban the export of strong encryption technology, the so-called crypto wars, and protecting the writing and sharing of computer code as an act of free speech under the U.S. Constitution's First Amendment. In the last decade, the Electronic Frontier Foundation has turned its attention to protecting the right of independent researchers to plumb the workings and security of software and hardware, and then report what they've learned without fear of legal repercussions. EFF has launched a so-called Coders' Rights Project, and now the group is looking to expand its work throughout the Americas, drawing on rights recognized by the American Convention on Human Rights and examples from North and South American jurisprudence. To find out more about what the EFF is up to, we invited Kurt Opsahl, the Deputy Executive Director and General Counsel of Electronic Frontier Foundation, into the Security Ledger studios. Kurt and I talk about the Coders' Rights Project and EFF's new report, Protecting Security Researchers' Rights in the Americas. We'll provide a link to that on our webpage. I started out by asking Kurt to talk about the Coders' Rights Project and what it's all about.
The Coders' Rights Project, this is something that we at the Electronic Frontier Foundation have been working on for many years, and it is designed to protect programmers and software developers who are engaged in some cutting-edge research exploration of technology. We work a lot with security and encryption researchers. A big part of that work is when somebody has questions about legal aspects of their research, that we can help advise them on how to conduct the research, as well as issues that arise from disclosing vulnerabilities, presenting the research, often in the form of conferences. So that has been like a lot of the heart of the Coders' Rights Project. Some of the work that we're doing stem from our work on code as speech, as recognizing the act of publishing code as an expressive activity, and that actually originally came up in the 1990s in the context of encryption research, and in particular when there were export controls that purported to ban strong encryption from being published on the internet, with the notion that if something's on the internet, that brought into mind exports, and this is of course coupled with the notion that encryption is in the same category as a munition. While, you know, you often might think of these things in terms of things like missiles and tanks, there was a notion for a very long time that encryption was a military technology. I mean, it did feature prominently in the military. And then things got a little bit more unusual on this when having strong encryption was something that was more accessible to ordinary civilians.
These were the crypto wars of the late 1990s, I think, is kind of how we refer to them now.
Indeed. This was all part of the crypto wars, or perhaps crypto wars part one, as we now are in crypto wars part two. So it turned out it was not the crypto war to end all crypto wars.
Right. And tell us what the crypto war part two is, hopefully better than Jaws 2.
I guess borrow from the movies, you know, The Empire Strikes Back, that after the 90s, there was a period of time in which strong encryption was relatively available to civilians, and there wasn't a lot of concerted effort from the government to suppress that. During this time period, there were a number of strong encryption programs available, but you had to be a fairly sophisticated user to use them. They were not very widespread. But some of that changed over the last decade, where encryption became more a matter of routine. And this started worrying the intelligence and law enforcement communities and sort of brought us back to them raising some of the same arguments mm-hmm. that had been raised in the first go.
The going dark argument, right? It's sort of the, if with this, you know, powerful end-to-end encryption, we're not going to be able to surveil and monitor dangerous actors, terrorists and others who would do us harm.
Exactly. Going dark was reinvigorated and trotted out again as an argument. You know, I have my disagreements with that argument, as you might imagine, comparably, we are living in sort of a golden age of surveillance. The amount of information that the government can readily access about people is growing at a faster rate than encryption is protecting that. But be that as it may, the government has reinvigorated this.
The Coder's Right Project goes back a number of years in the U.S. What EFF is doing now is really to expand the purview of the Coder's Rights Project to the Americas, down to Central and South America. Talk about a little bit about why now, at this moment in time, EFF is looking to evangelize the Coder's Rights Project south of the border here in North America.
One of the things that was an inspiration on this is the American Convention on Human Rights, which is a convention that many countries in the Americas are participants on, and it includes protections for freedom of expression, some fundamental human rights. So we began with doing some research into the legal standards and how they have been interpreted. And we found that this was actually what we think is a good basis for this. And at the same time, there is some opportunity a lot of these countries are beginning to turn their minds and their legislators to cybersecurity laws, hacking laws, trying to think about security, that it would be a good opportunity to promote this as they're having it, having these discussions, and try and get some of these ideas incorporated into the law. At the same time, we're recognizing that throughout the Americas, there are growing technology industries, and more of these things have important niches. I mean, one of the things that's come up in a couple of countries is election security, e-voting machines. And we have seen, at least in some cases, there's been pushback, as there have been in elsewhere in the world, from the powers that be that don't want to have their voting systems questioned or checked.
So as we look to let's say, outside of the U.S., South America, I certainly think of countries like Argentina and Brazil as having obviously a vibrant, not only technology scene, but also information security scene. I know Cesar Cerruto, Argentinian, has done some really phenomenal security research over the years. Mm-hmm. To speak in broad terms, is the legal environment there about the same as here in the U.S., more punitive, less punitive? Is it a matter of making laws, again, less strict and less punitive, or really just creating laws where none really exist right now?
It varies from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, and one of the things that really helped with this is we try to work with folks on the ground in countries who are very familiar with the local law and trying to apply. But that's why we were looking at the American Convention, because that is something that applies more generally. And so in mm-hmm. some cases, countries do have computer crime offenses. Some things that cross, and hopefully we can start to get a trend in determination, are sort of like, what is an unauthorized access? An issue that often comes up is whether a violation of the terms of use of a website makes the access unauthorized. We think that would be bad public policy to say that it does, because that essentially allows people to take private law and back that up with criminal penalties. Brazil, in particular, one issue that has come up a lot there is regarding encryption. They've had a number of disputes with WhatsApp, where they would like access to the communications that people are sending across WhatsApp. And, of course, WhatsApp is end-to-end encrypted. And so that's not something that WhatsApp can provide. And some of the things that have come from that have been that they will take Facebook executives, Facebook the parent of WhatsApp, put them in jail, saying that, you know, you'll fail to comply with our requirements, or they will say, you know, we're going to shut down WhatsApp for a period of time. And these things, you know, they usually get resolved. But it brings to mind another thing that sort of comes up in the context of our work, which is helping legislatures, policymakers, prosecutors, and such understand the technical issues that they are working with, and understand, you know, what it is they're asking for, why that would be easy, hard, difficult, and hopefully that would lead to a more sensible policy.
So up here in the U.S., some fairly big news on this front just within the last week, which is we had a ruling from the Librarian of Congress, and this is, we don't hear much about the Librarian of Congress, but could you talk a little bit about the ruling that came down, I think it was last week, and what the implications are? My understanding is it really expanded the types of devices that security researchers can work on well beyond kind of laptops and DVRs and DVD players and so on.
First of all, What is going on? Why is the Librarian of Congress involved here? That is due to the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, Section 1201, which says basically that you cannot break digital rights management under penalty of law. DRM is designed to stop people from copying things. It was passed in 1998. Because of the concern that computers and networks and the internet would make it too easy for things to get copied freely, and they wanted to penalize that. But at the time,
so things like movies and video games and music and stuff like that, copyrighted material.
Absolutely, absolutely. And maybe a little background is prior to that, there had been many circumstances in which the content industry would come up with a scheme designed to technically make it difficult for people to copy their materials, and it would be shortly thereafter broken, so they were sort of losing that race. And so they turned to Congress to try to make it illegal for someone to defeat them. But there was a concern, what about unintended consequences? What if there are useful things that would be prohibited by this law? And so they said every 3 years, the Librarian of Congress can examine potential exemptions to the law and, if convinced, can issue these exemptions.
Sure. And I mean, one of the things we're seeing is that the profile of a software-driven, copyright-protected thing has really expanded in the last 20 years or so, right, where we're, you know, now pretty much software is running a lot of stuff that didn't used to be run by software. So these types of copyright and DRM type features are turning up in more and more different types of devices.
They are, you know, with the they say the Internet of Things, more and more things that you would not have previously expected to have security issues now do. You know, you can have a toaster that has copyrighted software. It has an internet connection, and therefore, at least the potential for security problems. It's going to be especially challenging if the toaster manufacturer has not yet fully fleshed out their security team. As new industries get exposed to security research, there's often like a period of time before the security researchers and the industry kind of really understand each other. People are like, oh my, someone has found a flaw in my thing. The instinct is to squelch that. We don't want people to know about that flaw or say that the flaw is not real. And mature industries, this tends to go away. So, you know, if you want to report a security flaw to Google or to Cisco or Intel, they have programs for that. They have a path. They have people whose job it is to work with the security research community and try to improve the security. But for other companies who are not familiar with that, they don't really have that path, and sometimes that leads to conflict. So one of the things that often comes up in the Coders' Rights Project work is helping researchers navigate sort of these first contact situations between industries and security researchers.
It's like one of those tribes in the Amazon that's never encountered civilization before or something, right? The security researcher kind of walking into the clearing. I mean you no harm, you know.
Indeed, and I think for a lot of these companies, they're not familiar with that community, and sort of flip it to PR or legal instead of to the engineers. And to sort of loop that back into the DMCA just briefly, one of the challenges is that without these exemptions from recent rulemaking, that's one more hammer that a company who wants to suppress information about their security flaw has available. And say, mm-hmm. You may be able to publish this information about the security flaw, but you better watch out because they're going to go after you for 1201 if you do so, and gives them some sort of leverage. Mm-hmm. And if that means that the product continues to be flawed and people don't know about it, that's a bad policy result.
So one of the issues we cover a lot here on the podcast and at Security Ledger is the sort of ongoing, and which I think is somewhat related to what we're talking about, is the effort in many states to pass right to repair legislation to legalize or clarify the laws around the rights of owners and independent repair people to do much of what we're talking about, maintain, service, update, modify electronic devices, network devices, connected devices that may have, you know, some protected, copyrighted software on them. What's EFF's position on that, and how does right to repair fit into this broader kind of coder's rights project?
Well, I think it's definitely something that EFF has worked on, but I think it's a very important thing because, just to state the problem, it used to be, you know, if you bought something and you wanted to fix it, you just had to open it up, bring out some tools, and start going at it. Mm-hmm. Buy a repair manual and figure out how to do. But then, as software got added to devices, then this added some complexities. There's like end user license agreements that would purport to limit your ability to tinker with the products that you otherwise would own. Don't reverse engineer it. Don't use a unauthorized repair source. And then you can sort of complicate that with digital rights management designed to make it difficult to do this, and then backing that up with Section 1201. And this disempowers the users. It means that you are dependent on the original reseller, that it can only go to the original reseller to change a battery on your device or to even do, you know, simple repairs. Then you don't have competition in that service. Independent repair shops get driven out of business.
And the OEM, the manufacturer, gets kind of a virtual monopoly or a de facto monopoly on the aftermarket for their product.
The funny thing about copyright is it's one of the areas in which we have said there can be a monopoly, right? That is actually the whole point of a copyright, is you have the right to exclude others from copying things under appropriate circumstances. But if you use that right, which was designed to incentivize creativity help out authors, to extend it to areas outside of that field, then you can start to have unintended consequences that end up with bad results. I think right to repair is one of those areas where we didn't do this via having a discussion and passing some legislation that would affect your right to repair things, but rather people using other tools like the Section 1201 and contract law and the copyrights of software to impose this regime where, as a society, we actually had gone the opposite direction in promoting competition. So it shows some of the dangers of a superextension of copyright. And for those who are tinkerers, it means that they are restricted in what they can do and what they can tinker with, improve, give away to a friend, the various products they're using.
As you look to roll out this Coder's Right project extend its reach, what's EFF going to be up to in the coming months?
So, next week I'm headed down to Sao Paulo, Brazil, where I'm going to present at a security conference down there, also meet with some folks in the security hackerspace community, and we're going to talk a bit about the Coder's Rights Project that we have just announced with the paper, and also provide a little bit of practical aspects of you know, some of the things that we've learned from advising security researchers over the years, trying to look at things which are applicable across many jurisdictions. But most importantly, to meet the community, to talk to people, find out what their concerns are and what areas we could work together and collaborate.
Kurt Upsall, Deputy Executive Director and General Counsel at Electronic Frontier Foundation, thanks so much for coming on and speaking to us on the Security Ledger podcast.
My pleasure.
Kurt Upsall is the Deputy Executive Director and General Counsel of the Electronic Frontier Foundation. He was talking to us about EFF's Coders' Rights Project. Up next, the curious thing about Internet of Things security standards is how many of them there are, a dozen or more. It's a situation that kind of defeats the idea of standards to begin with, but in the end, any individual standard matters a lot less than who or what is behind it. That's why the Security Ledger took note when the internet giant AT&T announced that it was partnering with the firm Ericsson to certify the security of Internet of Things devices using standards developed by the industry group, the NTIA. AT&T's clout as the network across which so much Internet of Things communications and data travels gives it an outsized importance in determining what kinds and how much endpoint security is needed. To understand AT&T's thinking about how to secure endpoints on the Internet of Things and Internet of Things ecosystems, we invited Senthil Ramakrishnan of AT&T's IoT security group to come in and talk to us. In this conversation, Senthil talks about some of the common security problems AT&T finds with internet-connected devices on its network and how it's working to try and push better security practices down to its customers.
Senthil Ramakrishnan, lead member of technical staff. We have broken down the entire IoT ecosystem into three main layers: the IoT device itself, which is collecting the data; the IoT network, which is transporting the data from the device; and the backend application, which is receiving the data and then, you know, processing that data to garner value off of it. We also have one additional layer called the threat management layer that sort of wraps around the entire IoT ecosystem. What we quickly understood as we were deploying IoT security and IoT solutions was that each one of these layers needs to be independently secured, and these layers still need to work together from an end-to-end security point of view. And that's essentially what we've been doing. Connectivity and networks being AT&T's bread and butter, that network piece was already secure for us. And you know, that evolution path for newer networks or newer types of networks, that continues with security in mind. But the back-end application, you know, that usually sits, if it's an AT&T application, it sits in our cloud. If it's a customer's application, it's either in their own cloud or in one of the public CSP providers. But all of those have a lot of security tools built in, essentially because they're very similar to IT deployments. That leaves the device layer very vulnerable, mainly because of the heterogeneous nature of the IoT devices. Not many IoT devices are the same, meaning the hardware is different, the software is different, the resource and capabilities of each one of those devices are different. And within an enterprise, they're going to deploy multiple IoT solutions, smart buildings, maybe smart manufacturing. They're going to have fleet management. And so it's not possible to have a single device-side security solution that can be deployed across all of your IoT deployments. And so that these devices didn't already come with a easily manageable security solution on board. The second issue was that most of the enterprises bought their devices from someone else, right? There was a module vendor or a system integrator who built these devices, and enterprises would just go purchase them. So they didn't have a lot of say in the requirements or the security requirements or the security design that went into these devices. So as we deployed solutions, both for us as well as for a lot of our customers, we quickly realized that the device was most likely the most vulnerable as well. And so we quickly looked at deploying multiple, device-side security solutions. We've done things like certificates on a SIM, trusted execution environments, anomaly detection of the device itself at the network layer. So we started putting out a lot of solutions. But, we first needed to show customers how vulnerable their devices are, right? Because anytime security comes into play. Of course, there's a cost and resource factor that comes in, and enterprises are not going to invest in securing any part of the ecosystem unless a clear risk assessment is done and shown to them. And so that's when we started talking to several industry bodies, and that includes the GSMA organization, the CTIA organization, and we started working with these organizations to understand how we can improve IoT device security. And the CTIA effort was one of the first that came out.
CTIA is the for folks who don't know, it's kind of a wireless industry group, right?
Yeah, it's and GSMA is the other one, right? That's more a global organization, where CTIA is more United States based, right?
Uh-huh.
CTIA came to us and several other carriers and said, hey, let's all get together and figure out what we need to do to ensure that the devices that get put on our networks are secure.
So is it going to be a condition of deploying on AT&T's network that they would have this certification, or is this merely a value-added service that you're going to offer?
So this is a value-added service, really, because we've got about, I think, 45 million devices on our network, and logistically it's going to be very difficult to, test every device that gets on our network, right? We do pick, if it's a critical application, then of course the devices have to be tested. So we work with our chief security office here within AT&T to define what that testing needs to be. But from a customer side, it is a value-added service that they can take on, to get a better idea of their risk assessment.
And you mentioned, for example, the default password, admin, password configuration that's sadly common out there with connected devices. What are some of the other common security failures that both you guys see in the types of devices, that end up getting deployed as internet-connected devices?
We sort of have a, almost like a top 10 of what these security issues are. Some of the common ones really are, keeping some unnecessary services running like Telnet or SSH on your devices, right? So you have your admin, your default admin password or password. There's like 20, 30 combinations that are very common. So you have that set, and then you also have Telnet or SSH or something like that turned on. So now people can directly talk to this device, right? And then using, unencrypted data, you'd be surprised how often that happens. So that's one of the first questions we ask our customers. We're like, hey, we're happy to transport your data for you, but do you encrypt it? Of course, there's inherent security built into the network, but on the device, data at rest still needs to be secured as well. So that's pretty common. That's data at rest. Data transmit is the same thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if a lot of customers might use the cellular network for the initial data transfer, but from our core network, they might choose to send it over the internet. And some of it might be in clear text. It's plain HTTP versus HTTPS, right? And so that's those are issues. Customers don't have lockouts or, timed lockout on the number of password attempts to their devices or even applications. So you could just sit there and brute force it and try to gain entry into the device or into the back end. So those are some of the common issues that we see. And those are, as you can see, right, those are easily identifiable and easily fixable as well. So it's kind of the starting point.
One of the challenges, obviously, is sometimes companies don't become aware of these or don't think about security until fairly late in the product development process, maybe even as they're going to try and deploy it in production. How do you get this type of security awareness instilled earlier in the product speccing and design phase so that it's easier to implement, right? It's on a bolt-on.
Yeah, and it really starts, I've said this before, but it really starts at the C-level, Paul, because they need to understand the differences between IoT and IT. Most enterprises that are deploying IoT today essentially turn to their IT teams and say, hey, go figure out how we're going to do this fleet solution. And so the IT teams use their existing set of people and use their existing set of tools to go solve this IoT security problem. And you know, like I mentioned earlier, the devices are different, the softwares are different, the applications are different, the behavior of both the devices and the applications are different. So, you know, the set of tools necessary to maintain security for these solutions is very different. And so what we've done is, you know, I think a couple quarters ago, there was a cybersecurity insights report that AT&T put out that was specific to IoT security. And it was really targeted at the C-level because we wanted to educate those people at that C-level and then let that education flow down, right? And then we've got multiple white papers. We've got, you know, every customer engagement we have, we always start with security. So it's really trying to, any customer that comes to us and says, hey, I want to do IoT, we say, oh, great, we'll help you. But here's the biggest challenge you're going to face, which is security. We can solve some of it for you, and then, you know, you'll have to bring in other partners to solve other pieces for you. So that's one of the ways. We're also working with the module vendors to help build in some of these basic capabilities. You know, things like, we talked about passwords a lot, right? So making sure that a module vendor has unique passwords for each device, that sort of thing. So across the ecosystem, we're working with different partners, including the customers, to sort of educate and drive a more secure framework for the ecosystem.
Do we get to a point where, you know, these types of certifications are standard, you know, or kind of the five-star safety rating for IoT devices, you know, that you're not going to buy one and deploy it if it doesn't have one of these certifications?
No, I think the industry as a whole, you know, not just the wireless industry, but the IoT industry as a whole has quickly realized that they need to, you know, step in and start, you know, figuring out this IoT security issue or challenge before it, you know, it explodes and, you know, we have a lot of regulation and other things come in. Right? There are really no standards around IoT today.
Or actually, there are a ton of standards, I guess. That's one of the problems.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I was going to say. There's too many, you know, alliances and organizations pushing their own set of you know, the requirements and frameworks. But, you know, the industry as a whole is quickly realizing that, hey, we have to come together and we need to start solving this IoT security issue. And this CTIA effort is one of those. I will say the GSMA effort is another one. If you go to the GSMA IoT website, you'll see a lot of documentation that AT&T has helped develop specifically around IoT security. And it, you know, while the CTIA effort is centered around the device initially, the GSMA effort extends, you know, across the entire ecosystem. So I think, you know, that is going to help a lot because, you know, every piece of the IoT ecosystem is now going to understand what they need to do, and that's going to be built in. And the education of customers and, you know, whether it's a consumer or whether it's an enterprise customer, that education is happening very quickly. So I think the IoT security issue is you know, it's never solved, but, you know, everybody's going to be aware and is going to include it in their design. Whether the testing is going to be mandatory, that is very difficult to say. You know, it depends on the risk and the type of IoT device and on the vertical and, you know, the criticality of that service. So, you know, I don't think you can put out one blanket statement that says, I mean, every IoT device has to be tested. You know, on the consumer side, I think there's a lot of regulation that's coming out now for consumer IoT, and you know, some of that might follow on here in the U.S., but the industry is really stepping up to take lead here.
You're, you know, sitting there at AT&T in their IoT group doing IoT security. What are you seeing in the trends, both in terms of IoT adoption and also on the security front? Are things getting better, more secure, more robust, or are we still struggling with the same problems we've been struggling with for the past few years?
Most enterprise customers have the need to deploy IoT, right? There's a lot of value to deploying IoT. There's cost saving. You're getting additional data that you can generate value out of, especially with, you know, machine learning and AI growing really quick. So growth in IoT is going to continue, and it's going to accelerate as well. And one big reason for that is things are getting a lot more secure. Which means it's going to be a lot more easier to deploy IoT. And then specifically for us here at AT&T, as we start going up the stack and start pushing out these end-to-end solutions, security is integrated into it, right? So if you come to AT&T and you purchase a smart city solution or a connected car solution, you know, the security is integrated into that entire solution end-to-end, right? And so for an enterprise, it makes it easy to take that solution and integrate it into their IoT deployment. And so I think that explosion in IoT is going to happen. You know, I think it's gathering speed, so it's that exponential growth is going to happen very soon. New security challenges are going to keep coming up, right? But there's a lot of new technology like AI, machine learning, edge computing, even blockchain that can potentially help keep these IoT solutions secure. You know, the key is going to be being able to secure these solutions for the lifetime of them. Right. So if you look at any current device, you know, I don't keep my iPhone for more than a couple years. Right. But my IoT device is going to stick around for 10 to 15 years, especially on the enterprise side. So being able to secure that for the life cycle of the lifetime of that device is going to be key.
Sendhil Ramakrishnan of AT&T, thank you so much for coming on to speak to us on the Security Ledger podcast.
Hey, thank you for having me again.
Sendhil Ramakrishnan is a lead member of AT&T's Internet of Things Security Group. He was here to talk to us about AT&T's program with the firm Ericsson to certify the security of IoT endpoints.